So, the beginning of Perek Vav, which we started last week, the sixth chapter, the Alter Rebbe mentioned the concept that everything that happens in Kedusha happens in the other side of Kedusha. So therefore, since we went through the 10 powers of the Nefesh HaLakis, Galdisol, and the three garments of the Galdisol, which is thought, speech, and action of Torah and Mitzvahs, whenever we engage in Torah and Mitzvahs, our 10 powers of the Nefesh HaLakis are grasped, and when it comes to learning, it grasps also, not only is grasped, but it grasps as well. The concept of Torah and Mitzvahs, and that in turn connects us with Hashem and grasps Hashem, because Hashem and his Torah are one. And in the fifth chapter, he went into great detail with a specific advantage of learning, because learning is that internalization and that bond, the two-way bond that doesn't exist in the physical. But then he says in the sixth chapter, he says that this must be therefore a similar thing. It must be 10 powers of the Nefesh HaBamis, the animal soul, and the three garments. Now, when he talks about the ten, he reverses the order. He starts with emotions before intellect. As he said, because in the Nefesh HaKis, emotions are given birth to by, in other words, the default position is not to have love of Hashem and fear of Hashem in a full physical blown way. Therefore, that has to be given birth to by the intellect. The Nefesh HaBamis is not like that. The Midos, the emotions are impulsive and they're there and they're instinctive. They're just channeled and revealed through the Seichel. And that's why it depends on the maturity. In other words, when the maturity of the Seichel increases, so does the sophistication of the bad emotion, basically, right? So like, for example, I gave an example of a taiva, something wants something, so a child just wants little silly things, whereas an adult just wants big silly things, but just more sophisticated things, more developed things, right? Same thing with anger. A child will be angry about really silly things, and what will bother an adult is more sophisticated things. Okay. Now, that's that. And then he said, When we exercise these emotions, meaning that these emotions or these perspectives of the Nefesh HaBamis are then put into thought, meaning we think them, we maintain them, we sustain them, or we speak about them, or we act upon them, then same thing is happening, like with the Nefesh HaKis. Our 10 powers of the Nefesh HaBamis is entering into and getting dressed up in the three garments of Klippa, the three garments of the opposite of Kedusha. Yep? Okay. Now, we started to talk about this last week, but now we're going to see it inside and just go through it properly. And he says that he wants to define, what do we mean? What are we talking about? What thoughts, what speech, what actions become the garments of Klippa, right? And as I started telling you last week, what he's going to reveal to us is that we're not talking about only, we're talking about also, we're not certainly not talking about only thought, speech, and action of averis, of wrongdoings, of transgression. Right? That's not, you don't need Tanya for that, right? What he says is, it's thought, speech, and action of anything that is not Hashem, that is not for Hashem, or holiness of Hashem. And that's what he says. Now, let's try and go through this a little bit. Okay, he says like this. The hein haim. We talk about thought, speech, and action of the garments of Klippa. The hein haim, they are kol hamasim. It starts with actions. All the actions, ashenasim tachas hashemesh, basically are done under the sun. Okay? Meaning anything that's not directly Torah mitzvahs or for Hashem, right? Asher hakoil hevel, hine quotes a pasuk. That all the stuff that is done in this world is all hevel. It's hard to translate hevel. The word hevel comes from Koheles. You know Koheles? One of the books of Shlomo HaMelech, right? Ikklazi, whatever you call it. Ecclesiastes, was it? Ecclesiastes, yeah. It's one of the words I can't pronounce. right. Hevel means like junk, like rubbish, like emptiness, right? Ru'us ruach. Shlomo Melech says ru'us ruach. The simple pshat of ru'us ruach means just pursuit of wind. Wind meaning is like it's nothing. It's just bobomasis, right? K'moshe kasev b'zohar, like it says in Zohar. But the Zohar takes it a bit further and takes it a bit of a deeper pirush. And actually, the word ru'us ruach, the word ru'us could mean pursuit of. It could mean, you know, words in Hebrew often have many, many translations, right? But it can also mean to break, right? You know, it's interesting, when it comes to Rosh Hashanah, we use that for trua sometimes. That the trua sound, which is the broken up sound, refers to the tshuva and the, like, the breaking of the soul, where a person just had breaking point and just like really regrets being far from Hashem. And he has that broken heart, the positive broken heart we're talking about being distanced from Hashem and yearns to return, right? Even deeper than the tkiya. So that's used when it comes to the word trua. But over here he's saying the same word. Ru'us can mean breaking. And rucha, according to the Zohar, doesn't necessarily mean wind in the negative sense like emptiness. Rucha actually refers to the spirit of Hashem. So therefore, we talk about all the actions of this world, the mundane actions that are not for Hashem's sake, are hevel, they're junk, and also ru'us ruach. They break, so to speak, they divide between us and the spirit of Hashem. That's the Zohar that he's quoting here, right? So that's actions, all the actions that we do that are for no purpose. V'chein kol hadiburim, and so to all the speeches, all the things we say, v'chol ha-machshoveis, and all the thoughts that we have, asheloi la-Hashem heima, that are not for Hashem, meaning they're not ul-ratzoin, they're not according to His will, ul-avidosi, they're not in order to serve Him. All of that is included in what we call the three garments of klipa. Right? And he says, shezeu pirish loshen sitra achra. That's the explanation of the language we say sitra achra. We call impurity, we call it klipa or sitra achra. Klipa means it's a skin because it hides Hashem. But sitra achra means she'enoi pirush tzad acher. It's another side. Sitra achra means the other side, right? She'enoi tzad agdusha, just not holy. Another thing that's everything that's not holy is klipa. That's what we call a sitra achra. No middle ground. Now we'll see later there is on some level middle ground, only because we'll see later, but at the end, towards the end of the chapter and beginning of the next chapter, we'll see there's two kinds of klippas. There are klippas that are complete klippa, which they're not even elevatable at all. And then there's klippa, which are neutral things, which can be elevated. They have some spark of kedusha in them, which you can use to channel. But if you don't use to channel them, so for example, I mean, the example obviously then, it's like he's eating kosher food, right? Kosher food, I mean, trefa food is complete klippa, so that's why you have to stay away from it, because you can't even use it for the service of Hashem. Kosher food is also klippa, but it's klippa's noiga, it's neutral klippa because it has a spark and can be used for the right reason. But if it's not, if it's just mundane, then it's klippa. Okay?
Yeah, I'm just wondering about things like, you know, like working on a kosher job. It of itself is mundane and nothing.
Probably. Right, so what do you mean? If you're working, you work in a factory, and you're
Getting
away,
factory, right?
And you're doing nothing, you're just moving boxes.
Yeah.
To use an example, right?
No.
So that could be used for, the whole Vorte in Tanya is, that could definitely be used for Kedusha.
So because you use the money and...
So, it's an interesting thing, there are two levels of that. And Tanya doesn't so emphasize it so much, the Rebbe talks about it a lot. There's two expressions, I'll just bring it in now, just to clarify a bit. One expression is, kol ma'asecha l'shem shamayim, all of your actions should be for the sake of heaven. So in other words, I go to work, number one, I behave there in a way that a yid is supposed to behave, I don't do anything that's against halacha in business, number one, and also my sole intent for working and earning money is to be a yid, to give tzedakah, and to survive so that I can serve Hashem. That's b'chol ma'asecha l'shem shamayim. There is it, right? So that's, then it's not klippa. Right? In fact, working is a Jewish concept. I mean, it's not, right? Prikov says that one should work. The Gemara says that there was two approaches. One was Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, who says that if we really will Hashem Shemaim, if we really only did what Hashem wanted, we wouldn't need to work. Rabbi Shmuel says, no, you got to work, you're living. And says a lot of work for Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. But the Gemara says many people tried Rabbi Shimon's method, it didn't work. Because most of us are not at that level, that'll just fall from heaven somehow, right? And Alpi Chassidus is something deeper, because we're not on that level, because we're not supposed to be on that level, because actually we're supposed to bring Hashem into the world, right? So Hashem wants us to work. 6 days a week you should work, says the Torah, right? So working doesn't matter what you're doing, it doesn't have to be a Jewish job, it doesn't have to be a holy job, it can be anything. Right? So there is that idea that I'm doing it l'shem shemayim. There is a deeper level. It's hard to understand exactly what that means, but there's a deeper level that if you look at the words, you'll see it's deeper. It says not all your actions should be for the sake of heaven, but it says b'chol drachecha do'ayu, in all your ways you shall know him. That somehow you use the job itself for kedusha. That's harder. Understand? In other words, I can go to work from 9 to 5. I can be shifting boxes. I can be building walls, whatever the case is. And it's for the sake of heaven. Everything I'm doing is only because I want to survive and give tzedakah and be able to feed my family and serve Hashem and be healthy and serve Hashem and learn Torah, right? Okay. But the actual thing I'm doing is not necessarily holy. Then there's a way where you can actually use the thing itself. Like, for example, you can make a kiddush Hashem. You can try and see the hashgacha pratis on every step of the way. And then it's a deeper and a harder level to do. Right? But they're both kedusha. Right? They're both high levels, put it that way. Right? If I say, probably none of us can say we do everything in our life with Shem Shemaim, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's hard, right? Maybe in theory we believe in that, and that's we should do. We should build up that mindset, first of all. But it's hard to say we do that.
But if you're only going to work because you need to survive, then this is Shem Shemaim.
Yeah, but I'll give you an example. Let's say, I mean, where this reflects, right? Where this could make a difference even at our level. Like, what's your priority? How much do you put into work? Like, does your work become an end in itself, or does it become a means to an end, right? That has to do with how much time a person spends there, how much they're going to give it, undermining other important priorities. Right? Unfortunately, in this world, people do work for the sake of work. And also, what are we going to use the money for? What are we going to use anger? All that kind of stuff, right? So it's the reason that Tanya is written at length is because it's not easy. It wasn't meant to be easy, this process. No, no. But it lays the foundation. It tells us the truth, first of all. Then it tells us the steps we need to take to get there. Or to get towards there, at least. Right? Okay. So this is the Vartya saying is that Sitra Achra means it's the other side. The fact that it doesn't express Hashem on its own, right away is already clipper, right? I thought of this word at the very beginning of Tanya where he introduces the Nefesh Abamis, right? An interesting thing, people often miss that he says the first neshama of a Jew is the Nefesh Abamis, and he says it's a Nefesh that comes from Klipper and Sitra Achra, right? And we asked the question at the beginning, what do you mean it comes from Sitra Achra? He didn't do anything wrong yet. When a person's born, the Nefesh Abamis hasn't done anything wrong. Why do you call it Klipper? Right? And the answer is because klipah doesn't mean there's something wrong. Klipah means it's unholy. The fact that a person has a nefesh abamis, which by definition is animalistic, by definition is not godly, by definition doesn't reveal God naturally, is klipah. It's already klipah. Why is it important to know? Because klipah has to be managed. You know what I'm saying? It's a very secular thing today that there's no part of you that's bad or that's unholy or wrong or whatever. That's not true, according to Chassidus. We all are born with parts of us that are rough, unholy, klipah. It doesn't make us not normal, it doesn't make us bad people. It makes us a normal person. A normal person has a part of him or her that is unholy, the nefesh abamis. Klipah needs to be managed. Klipah needs to be seen for what it is. You've got to subjugate Klipa, you've got to control it, you've got to put it into place, you've got to sometimes even break it, spiritually speaking. Right?
Yeah.
Not to be confused, you know, that it's interesting, I saw recently, and this is why there's such confusion today, even in people that write Torah ideas, where they are influenced by modern stuff and then they confuse the issues of Chassidus, right? So I saw an article in a magazine that someone wrote. Someone who's promoting health, which is not a problem at all. It's 100% right, right? And healthy living, it's a mitzvah in the Torah. One should live healthy, one should eat healthy, 100%. I don't think that mitzvah is one of the 13 principles of faith that should become a whole focus and obsession. But it is a mitzvah. It's a mitzvah like all mitzvahs, right? Okay. Which are all important. Good. incidentally, just let me... There's a word that Hasidim used to say, you know, Hasidim were renowned, that living a life according to Hasidus means not only doing mitzvahs, but because your whole life becomes God-centered, you are mahadr in mitzvahs. You do it extra. You don't just do the bare minimum, you do it behidur, you do a lot, right? You don't eat just a small kazayis and matzah and pesach light. You try a big kazayis just in case. It's a bit whatever, right? All these things. You don't have just cheap tefillin. You have expensive tefillin. Not cheap mitzvahs, expensive mitzvahs. Okay. So there's a vart for Chassidim that all the mitzvahs shehaguf nenevohem, any mitzvah that the body has benefit from it, Chassidim weren't mahadur. They did it, but they weren't. They didn't. They weren't machmir. Why? Because there's a big problem with mitzvahs that have the body enjoys, and that is that. Not always doing it for the mitzvah. Right? So yes, of course, the mitzvah to have pleasure on Shabbos. Okay, so that doesn't mean you're going to sit and fresh from morning to evening. Big chassidim weren't, they suddenly didn't become so frugal when it came to that mitzvah. I mean, they did the mitzvah, of course, they washed, they ate bread. The real chassidim used to eat very little even on Shabbos. Right? Why? Because they were scared that it's going to change not from the mitzvah, to the body, the nefesh habamis enjoying itself, right? And so on. So that's the famous idea of the Baal Shem Tov, that he said he saw an ox with a strimal eating chalt. You know, I think I've shared that with you before. The Talmidim of the Baal Shem Tov once saw Baal Shem look at the window, and he says he sees an ox with a strimal eating chalt. So he said, what's that supposed to mean? What it meant was, he saw a chassid who had a strimal, that's what the chassidim were, and he was fressing chalt, but it had nothing to do with Shabbos. It had to do with, it was an ox with a strimal eating chalt, and Nefesh HaBamis was enjoying himself, right? So, oh, what was I getting? Yeah, so this guy wrote an article, and he said, he was talking about you have to take care of your body. And he said that we know that the Baal Shem Tov said, a famous word of the Baal Shem Tov he quoted, that's why it's such a big mitzvah to take care of your body, because every part, there's nothing in your body, nothing in you that's unholy. Now, what's the word of the Baal Shem Tov? He missed part of the key part of the word of the Baal Shem Tov. Because now the Baal Shem Tov was against fasting, unless only the fast that we have to fast, right? Baal Shem Tov was against breaking the body, because you need to bring the body along to serve Hashem, right? Okay, so Chassidus revealed, I mean, there was quite a way of serving Hashem to completely break oneself and fast a lot and things like that. Chassidus doesn't approve of that, especially the way the Rebbe learns it, because, no, the body is needed. The body is a vessel which has potential, has a lot of potential. Yes, it is klipa, as we'll see later, it's klipa's noiga, it's neutral klipa, but it is klipa. It needs to be put in its place, but it needs to be brought along, and therefore it shouldn't be broken, it should be used. It should be pulled along and schlepped into the journey of serving Hashem, right? Not broken. That's why the Rebbe always used to tell people, if people used to fast a lot, they used to be very upset. He used to always say, it's not the derech of the Baal Shem Tov, and so on and so forth. Having said that, by the way, the Rebbe used to fast a lot himself, that's not, which is interesting. He was doing it for us, I think. But anyway, that's a separate story. Okay. This was even before he became Rebbe. In fact, there's a letter from his father that was printed in the last few years begging him not to fast so much. Anyway, that's another topic. But, okay, so what's the word of the Baal Shem Tov? The word of Baal Shem Tov is based on a pasuk in Chumash. The pasuk says, it's the mitzvah of helping someone load or unload a donkey, right? Yeah, are you familiar? It's one of the 630 mitzvahs. It says like this, Kisira chamor, if you see a donkey, soin acha, that of your enemy. In other words, meaning even if it's someone you mamash don't like, it's your enemy, right? Anybody's got this donkey and it's gonna break, it's breaking under the load, and he has to unload, offload, whatever the case is. Says the pasuk, v'chadalta ma'azov lo, you might refrain from helping him. That's wrong. Ozov tazov imoy, help him together with him. In other words, bring him along, do it with him together. Said the Baal Shem Tov, what's the spiritual translation of this pasuk? Said the Baal Shem Tov like this, Ki sirah chamor. When you have a look in yourself, you'll see the chamor, the coarseness, the animal part of you. Nefesh HaBamis, in other words, right? Soinacha, you will see it's your enemy. It is your enemy. However, because it's your enemy, v'choldalto ma'azoiv loy, you're going to think, I shouldn't help him, I should work against him, I should break the body. No, ozav tazav imoy, you don't break the body, put it in its place, but bring it along, right? Put in its place something that Alter Rebbe talks about much later in Tanya. Sometimes you need to have that regret or guilt, and whatever the case, whatever the method is that Alter Rebbe describes later on in Tanya, right? I'm just saying, two things are true. Of course you shouldn't break the body. The body has potential, the body is but the body is sustained by the Nefesh HaBamis. Nefesh HaBamis is klipa. Can't say nothing of us is unholy. Of course it's unholy. The Nefesh HaBamis is Sanach, it's your enemy. That's what the pasuk says. That's the key part of the verse. It is your enemy. Yet you have to understand the method is not to break it, but to capture it, to transform it, to channel it, whatever the case is. Okay. How do we get into this? Oh, yeah, so...
I asked about work.
So, that's right. Okay. No, that's a good question. No, that's good clarification. Okay. So that's Sitra Achra. Now, why is that? So let's go to the next line. It says, because Vitzadak, we say Sitra Achra means that side opposite to Kedusha. Why? Vitzadak Kedusha, what is the side of Kedusha? Kedusha means, Eina Ela, what is Kedusha? Right? This is an interesting definition. What is Kedusha? I mean, there are a number of definitions of Kedusha, but what is Kedusha? Kedusha means, Einoi Ela, only refers to something. It refers to Hashra V'Hamshacha Mikdushasei Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Kedusha means where the holiness of Hashem is dwelling. Hashra means to dwell and the bringing down from the holiness of Hashem. Right? In other words, Kedusha means... Kedusha doesn't just mean when you're disconnected from the world. Because Kedusha does have that translation. Kedusha has actually have the translation as disconnection, separation. Right? We have that sometimes the word Havdalah associated with Kedusha, when you separate from something, right? That's like Hashem is transcendent. That's why he's Kadosh, right? So Kedusha means not just what I hold back, but also much more than that. Kedusha means when I'm a vehicle for Hashem's presence to be felt. For godliness to be felt. Now, how can godliness be felt? Look at the next line. V'ein HaKadosh Baruch Hu Shoyre, we know that Hashem does not rest, the Shechina is not felt, Elo al dover shebotel etzlo yizbarech. The Shechina can only be felt in something that is completely surrendered to Hashem, completely given over to Hashem. It's not just enough that the thing or the person is doing some good things. The experience or the mindset or the person has to be completely surrendered to Hashem. Right? That's in other words, that's the depth of the Gemara. The Gemara in Soita tells us, there's a whole long, a few pages there where it goes on about the concept of arrogance, right? So it says there that Hashem says he can tolerate, he can rest with everyone, he can coexist with any person. No matter how bad they are, but not if they're arrogant. Right? So we say when someone's not arrogant, that's, you know, a person can be not arrogant, they can be a bit humble. But in the deeper pshat, when we say that Hashem can only rest when there's no arrogance, it means deeper than that. Arrogance in Kedusha means not just that he's not an arrogant person, he's a humble person. It means that he's totally given over to Hashem. That's what arrogance. He's totally surrendered. Which in Chassidus we call idea of bittul, right? Bittul, idea of complete surrender to Hashem. That's when Hashem rests. And that's when it's holiness. Anything that is not complete bittul to Hashem, right? Anything that is not complete surrender to Hashem, meaning that is not a vessel for that total Kedusha, that becomes Sitra Achra. That's Klippa.
But how do you live in total surrender to Hashem, like on a daily basis? What must I do here differently?
So, again, it goes back. I think it goes back to what we always talk about, right? In a total, extreme way. What do I mean? You always have to learn in something how it is in totality, and then understand that not everyone lives like that. Most people don't live in totality, but they live in a mindset that works towards that. Explain what I mean, right? So. The mindset of Bittul is that nothing else exists besides Hashem. In other words, to really be in a state of Bittul, you have to learn the second part of Tanya. That's why the two parts of Tanya actually come together. First part of Tanya talks about the struggle between the Nefesh HaBamis and Nefesh HaLakis. Nefesh HaBamis is obviously naturally not Bittul, not surrendered to Hashem. The Nefesh HaLakis is, at least potentially, as we'll soon see, right? And we have to take charge of the Nefesh HaBamis and bring Bittul even to the Nefesh HaBamis, okay? That's a struggle. Now, what does Bittul mean? You can only really understand Bittul if you learn the second part of Tanya, which is Shari Yechud B'Emunah, where it talks about the oneness of Hashem at a very, very deep level, taught by the Baal Shem Tov and expanded upon in Tanya. Doesn't only mean that we are secondary to Hashem or we listen to Hashem. It means that we understand that there's nothing else besides Hashem. Right? It can manifest itself in so many different ways. Like we understand that, for example, nothing has a true existence other than serving Hashem. So, person can say like this. I'll give you an example, the way it's explained always in Vibranians and Exodus. Person has a hand, right? Okay, you have a hand. My hand is a hand. Hashem gave me a mitzvah. I'll use a mitzvah that's more relevant to women. A mitzvah to light Shabbos candles. Okay. So because I know that I have to first listen to Hashem, so I light Shabbos candles, right? That's not complete bittul. Complete bittul means actually to understand my hand doesn't exist. Its entire existence is to light the Shabbos candles. The existence of the hand is to do the mitzvah of giving tzedakah, lighting the Shabbos candles. Right? That's a very different perspective. Now, what difference does it make? How, which perspective I have, as long as I do the mitzvah? It makes it very big because it makes a difference how I live my life, right? Now, so total bittul means for a benoni, the way it's been explained in Tanya, it means that at least in thought, speech, and action, it's always about Hashem. Everything is about Hashem, right? For the tzaddik, and actually much more than that, the tzaddik, which is not the book of Tanya, for the tzaddik, it means someone that just, even in his midrash, he never has a temptation, he's completely surrendered to Hashem. In tzaddikim itself, there's different levels, right? An example of a complete tzaddik, the way complete bittul is Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, for example, right? Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who said at the end of his life that I've reached the madrega of complete oneness with Hashem, and he didn't see himself as, he said about himself, and for a person who's not bottled, this would be a very arrogant statement, but because he was totally bottled, it wasn't arrogant, it was bittul. He said, Ano simono be'almo. I am just a code for Hashem. That's it, my holy being. That's what I feel like. I'm just a code for Hashem. Now, we're not that level. So again, the first thing we do in Chassidus is we build that mindset. And then we have that mindset affect us as much as possible, and it's a life's journey to keep growing with it, right? So what does bittul mean? Bittul means, the mindset of bittul bring? It brings that we're trying to live a God-centered life. It brings that we stop taking ourselves so seriously. It brings that we go out of our comfort zone, that we inconvenience ourselves for Hashem, we go out for another person, we make room for Hashem, make room for another person, we're not into self, that's what it means, and as much as possible, right? You know, I always tell stories of old Chassidim, who you saw this, like Chassidim that were certainly in previous generations, but even ones that we knew. I always you've heard me say this before, I always tell stories of Reb Mendel Futterfass, right? Just because he was like a symbol of bittul, like, just never is the most happiest guy, by the way, bittul is not a negative thing. On the contrary, it brings tremendous happiness. When a person is really bottled, it means he knows that he's not a silly, insignificant being. He's actually part of a much bigger reality. He's part of Hashem. Like, my independence is nothing. I'm nothing, but I'm connected to the Eibishter. That's great, right? So this is Remendel. Remendel was like, his whole life was the Eibishter. His whole life was Torah Mitzvahs. What did it bring to, for example, when he was in Russia? It brought to incredible Mesiras Nefesh. It brought to a time when he, there was a time in Russia where they, after the war, where they allowed Polish citizens to leave Russia. And the Yidden in Russia were then under extreme persecution. It was spiritually, right? So there was a whole underground campaign to falsify passports and get Yidden out of it. Which Remendel was one of the people that did that. And towards the end, he could have done one for himself and left. And he said he's not leaving until the last person is out. And he got caught just at the end. And he was in jail for 10 years in Siberia. Right? Or more than 10 years, I mean. So that's a person who was bottled to Hashem. Right? The Rebbe speaks, you know, we're coming up to Gimel. Once he asked the question, I think we're having more of a Fabrengen today than a Shiatani. It doesn't matter. It's important stuff, this. Right? The Rebbe speaks in the last mimer, right? I think this is the problem that we have sometimes, right? Because we it's hard for us to picture in our day. So I'll tell you something that the Rebbe says like this. The Rebbe says, there was a mimer that the Rebbe said many years ago, a Purim mimer, but he edited it. The Rebbe every so often used to edit mamorim, and then they were published as fully edited official mamorim, right? So the last mimer that the Rebbe edited was a few weeks before he had a stroke. Famous. It's very prophetic. It's quite incredible, actually. The Atat Tzave, famous mimer on Purim Katan. He talks about a lot of things there, but one of the things he talks about is the concept of Mesiras Nefesh. And at the end, he speaks about real Mesiras Nefesh. What's real Mesiras Nefesh? He says, he makes a distinction. He doesn't say these words, but it's obvious what he's talking about. He talks about the Mesiras Nefesh in Russia and the Mesiras Nefesh in America. Because at the end of the day, these great Hasidim, I mean, they're just unbelievable people, right? But because of the persecution, it triggered also, because they were so bottled and they learned so much Hasidus and they were so connected to the Rebbe and the whole thing. So it triggered that adrenaline, that mysterious nefesh that he's buried deep in Anashama, right? And he says, you find by some of these people, he hints to it in the Maimon, that some of these same Hasidim, definitely wasn't referring to Reb Mendel, because Reb Mendel was like, remained an unbelievable Hasid. But he says, some of these Hasidim, he says, you see, when they came to places where it was comfortable, the mysterious nefesh wasn't so recognizable. Because Yiddishkeit is not at stake. So if I wake up in the morning and I have to go daven, I have to go to a shir, and I sleep in, Yiddishkeit's not going to die, right? In Russia, Yiddishkeit was going to die, so you had to really go all out, right? But it's a mistake. So the real mysterious nefesh today could be much more simple things. That a person has the mindset of bittul, that it's not about me. It's about what Hashem wants us to do. And therefore, if I need to wake up in the morning and that's the calling, that's what Hashem wants me to do, I need to do it. My nefesh HaBamis doesn't want, and I want to shluff more, whatever the case is. But no, you got to jump out of bed. Or you got to do something for someone else. Or you do something you don't want to do. Or you got to do something you thought was the right, you know. All that kind of thing. So there's many, I mean, bittul can be expressed. So when you say, how do you live like that? Most of us are not going to be living like that. But we can live with that mindset and it can affect us. That's what I'm saying. It can affect us the way we live. It's a whole different way of living. It's a whole different way of living that it's completely, the attitude is, at least the attitude is that the way of living is that Yiddishkeit is at the center. I'm here to fit into Yiddishkeit, not Yiddishkeit to fit into me. That's what I'm saying. Like, It has, again, and everyone has their own journey and everyone has to always love. Like, for example, I'll give you another example. Like, we find in Hasidim or Hasidus that, for example, often we take upon stringencies of halacha that inconvenience people. Right? I mean, it's nothing more bizarre than a Babacha Pesach, for example, right? Why don't we just look for, say, no, there's a heter, there's a leniency, we could do it. Now, it's another discussion. There's room for leniencies, and sometimes people shouldn't take on stringencies only when they're ready, and things like that, because that can also have a bad effect. Obviously, everything in implementation has to be done carefully. But the mindset is, no, I don't mind inconveniencing myself, Hashem, because that's the whole purpose of it. It's not that I exist and I'm living and I'm enjoying life, but I understand that Hashem is boss, right? So I've got to fit into His rules. But wherever I can find the loophole, I will. Whenever I can make it convenient for me, I will. Right? Chassidus, it's not like that. It's the contrary. First priority is do what Hashem wants, because that's the only true thing. That's the only true existence. It's making me exist. It's making me inconvenient. Okay, so I'll be inconvenienced. Now, that's not to say that in halacha it says that sometimes you should be lenient and you can be lenient. That's a separate story, especially if it's inconvenience. Other people, there's lots of different manifestations of this, but the nekuda, the point, is that mindset of bittul. We live in a world today that's the complete opposite of bittul. Right? Because people are talking about their truth, their thing. This is the extreme opposite, right? Because there's no such thing as their truth. I don't mean their. It's not their. Yours. Not yours. Not mine. It's not me. It's not about me. It's about the truth. Now, I've got to work to fit into that truth. There might be my mission that's different to someone else's mission. That's true. That's not because that's what I feel is my. That's because I was taught by Torah or by a Rav or by the Rebbe or by Chassid or by Torah or whatever. Or I asked a Shaila and it came out that my mission is a particular mission. Someone else's mission is a different mission. That's different. That's a different story. Of course, we're all individual. We have a personality. We should use our personality. But it's not about finding a purpose that fits into me. It's not about fitting into me. The whole Shlichus movement, by the way, was based on that. I always say that if the early Shluchim were into self-care, like today people are talking about self-care, there would be no Shlichus. The Rebbe took young people, just married, away, tore them away from their family, sent them to Timbuktu, who knows where, and they just went. Why? Because you've got to go. That's why. Bittul. That's all it was. I have a friend who came here. It was amazing. I have a friend that came that just to show you the idea. Oh, again, today we're not such high madregas like the old Chassidim, but the perspective can be sometimes applied. So in Tavshin Mem Zayin, which is 1987, the year I got married, the Rebbe was talking about, there was every few years the Rebbe would reignite this concept, and he was talking about going on shlichus like on fire. I mean, week after week after week, right? To the point that I had a mashpia, a mentor at the time that was my mentor for that moment. I went to him and I said, well, maybe, and normally guys get married, they go to kollel first for a year, maybe I shouldn't, maybe I should just go get married and go on shlichus right away. So he said, no, you have to go to kollel and explain to you why. Okay, so I knew that's the right thing to do. But, so I have a friend who's my age, who was in yeshiva with me, got married a little bit after me, and he ended up in Riga. And I see him from time to time when I'm in New York, but I never really caught up with him. We're always on the go. He came a few months ago. He came here for a bar mitzvah of someone that's a donor of his and lives in Sydney, and there's a bunch of rabbonim came for, and he came. So I caught up with him. I spent a couple of hours with him. I asked him how it's going. Anyway, it turns out this Riga business is a real hard shlichus, right? I said, how did you land up in Riga? He said, you remember Tosh Mem Zayin? I said, I remember it very well. He says, when it came time for me to go on shlichus, I found that where is needed, I didn't know the language, my wife didn't know the language, we had no idea what we were going to do there, we had no idea what we were doing there, we went. Right? It's an unbelievable mindset. It's not a career. Right? I'm just giving you different examples of what Bittl could look like. There's many. But I mean, it comes from this idea that, see, I want to emphasize it again and again because people always, learn the stuff and they say, oh, it's beyond me. It's not beyond us. Of course it's beyond us in the extreme, in totality, but we have to learn it in totality first because we have to develop that mindset first, right? And then seek to find ways how it affects us, how it guides us, how it drives us, whether we live and so on and so forth, right? Anyway, let's keep going. Okay, so it says Hashem doesn't only rest, only on the thing that is totally surrendered. Now, what does it mean totally surrendered? For example, it says, Bein b'poil mamish k'malochim elyonim, either surrendered in actuality. For example, the malochim. We talk about in davening, we talk about the holy angels. Why do we talk about the holy angels? Why are they holy? Because they are connected to Hashem all the time. Because angels are beings, especially the higher level of angels, they are beings that totally are conscious of godliness all the time. They don't have a being on their own. They're totally surrendered to Hashem, right? So that's it. Bein b'koach, or bittul could take place with beings that are potentially able to be bottled. For example, like a Jew. A Jew has a neshama. So the neshama part of us has no connection to klipa. The neshama is surrendered. Why it says potential is because we need to reveal that bittul, right? So for example, in b'koyach, chol ishe solamata, like every Jew, she b'koyach, a Jew has a power. Liyois bottle mamish lagabe HaKadosh Baruch Hu. A Jew has the power to become completely bottled to Hashem, but mesiras nafshoi HaKadoshas Hashem, to the point of giving up his life for Hashem. Later on in Tanya, he talks about this idea that we all have total bittul within us. At the depth of our neshama, we are bittul. It's not conscious. Where does it come out, for example? It comes out, and throughout history, we find that sometimes people gave up their life for Hashem, even when they weren't such big people. I'm not talking about people understood and learned and understood. It could be a very simple person. It could even be a person that did things that Hashem doesn't want on a day-to-day routine level. But those very people, when they were given the choice, either bow down to an idol or either convert to Christianity or jump into the fire, they said Shema Yisrael and jumped into the fire. Why? What happened? Because at that point, they realized the pint of the yid is at stake. So they, why? Because the yid is essentially bottled. One of the big things that Tanya later is he guides us on how to work that through to understand that that everything we do wrong is subtly like Avodah Zorah, and therefore we should have a serious nefesh for everything. He guides us for how to bring the bittul to the consciousness. Okay, that's a big topic later on, which we'll have to get to, right? Yeah, but that's another thing. But a yid is has this concept of bittul. That's why the etzem of a yid, the essence of a yid is kedusha, is holiness, right? V'lochen omer Hazal, and that's why Chazal tell us shafilu echad sheyoshev oisik b'Torah shekhinah shrei. That even if one yid sits and learns Torah, when a yid learns Torah, he's really involving at that moment, he's involved in something really holy. Right? And connecting to something holy, the Shekhinah rests upon that yid. He might not be fully conscious of it, but the Kedusha is there because the Bittul is essentially there. Right? If we have 10 people, 10 yidin get together, it says, when 10 yidin get together, that creates a Kedusha, right? Because there's 10 neshamas coming together, even if they're not doing anything particularly amazing, but just the coming together, as long as they're not doing anything wrong, but, right, that's already a thing of Kedusha. Okay. Avol kol ma she'ein le'botel etzli yisbarach, but anything that's not totally bottled to Hashem, Elohu dover nifrad bifnatzwa, but he's something independent. So it doesn't have the shchina. So how does the person need? Now he talks about an interesting thing. So something's not bottle. Existence of klippa. An animal that is the nefesh habamis itself is klippa, right? Nefesh habamis itself on its default position is not holy. A kosher animal even is not holy. Or for sure a treif animal. So now the question is, how does it exist then? If it doesn't have the shchina, if the holiness of Hashem is not resting on us, how does it actually exist? Right? Because later on in Tanya, the second paragraph, says that everything in the world cannot exist without the spark of that drives it to exist. The creative force that is in every single chair, table, everything, right, has a creative force from Hashem. So how does it exist if it's not holy? So the idea is like this, that when he talked about holiness before, he meant a conscious, a revealed part of Hashem. He said like this, Avol kol ma she'eino batel etzli yisborach, anything that's not bottled to Hashem. Elohu dover nifra b'fnatzah, but he's more independent and separate. Einoi mekabel chayis mekdushose shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, does not receive its life force, livelihood, the vibrancy, from the holiness of Hashem, mepchines pnimiyas HaKadosha mehusav atzmusav b'chvoyde v'atzma. It doesn't receive its chayis, its life from Hashem, from the holiness of Hashem in an internal way, and I'll explain what that means in a second. Right, b'chvoido v'atzmo, Hashem's essence alone. Ella mipchinas achorayim, but it receives it from something we call achorayim, which is like backhanded, like from the back. What does that mean? The analogy of this, where he says achorayim means behind, it was like this, right? What happens if you really, really want to give someone a present, right? Or you really, really don't want to give someone something, but you do it because whatever reason. You need the person to do you a favor, or you need that person to get off your back, or whatever the case is, right? So, the present could be the same, but the way you give the present is completely different. Okay? If I give someone something I really like, that I'm giving it, but means I look at the person, I smile at the person. In other words, in both cases, the present's coming from me, but this is a very physical motion, it's not exactly accurate, but it brings up the point, right? The me is revealed in the present. In other words, right? Yeah, you give a present to someone you love, you give the card, right? What does the card do? It's the same present. What's the difference? You know, give me the mix master. What's the difference? Like, I can use the same thing. He gave it with a card, that card. No, the card's completely different. The card means that you part of the present. I can feel you part of the present. You feel the love. You feel the connection. You feel the card, right? If you have to give someone because you can't stand the person, but you know you have to give him anyway, so it should not drive you crazy. Yeah, take it. The you is not there. So of course, everything has something from Hashem. Everything has a spark. The difference is that Klippa gets its life force from Hashem, but first of all, gets the bare minimum, and it gets it in a very hidden way. It's not Hashem is not consciously present there. It's like Hashem giving it from the back. Like, take it, right? And he says not only, and it's a weakened, it's a diluted godly force. Sheyoridim, it comes down mi madrega le madrega, from one level to another level. Tzimtzum, right? River voice madregas, tens of thousands of levels, bishtalshulus oilemus, through the chain of many, many worlds, derech ilov olil, cause and effect, but tzimtzumim rabim, and many levels of tzimtzum. We've spoken about tzimtzum before, that Hashem hides it more and more and more and more, right? Achen ismait kol kacha oir v'achais, until the life force that Hashem is sending to that clipper has become so diminished and so diluted, so to speak, mute achar mute, one diminishing after another, Asher yochel li samtzim li slabish, until it can be contracted and actually go into bibchinas golus, in an exiled way, toich oise dovra nifred, in that independent and separate existence. In other words, another sort of moshel he's throwing in here, that when the life, like when Hashem rests on something that's bottled to him, that's surrendered to him, so there's presence, there's consciousness, there's feeling, and also Hashem kind of feels at home there, right? He's there, like he's there because he wants to be there. When Hashem gives the life force in a backhanded way, and it's in a diminished way, and it's tzimtzum after tzimtzum, he comes into that thing, but like he's exiled there. It's like trapped there. It's like being in prison, right? Living in your house or living in a prison cell. But in both places, you're existing in a room, but it's totally different. You, in your house, you're at home. In a prison cell, you're out of place. Right? So Hashem kind of that, right? Now, why does Hashem do that? Because he wants there to be klippa. Understand that? But that's not the purpose of creation. Right? He wants it to be the existence of klippa, so he does that. But, I mean, Like, he doesn't want to give them the present, so don't give it to them. No, obviously, because they wouldn't be able to exist. And Hashem wants Klippa to exist because he wants us to make a dwelling place in a world of Klippa. That's the purpose. So there has to be Klippa for that. But that's not his... That's because it has to exist. So he gives it its chayes. But that's not where he feels at home. The idea is for us to make him feel at home and to bring Bittul into the whole world. That's a separate issue. Okay. So he says he does that until it comes into Golus in that separate thing. L'chayosay, l'kaymoy, just to keep it alive. Me'ayin leher, something from nothing. Shalo yachsoy liyoin... So that it shouldn't return to nothingness, because we know that everything has to have a spark of Hashem's creative force in it. If not, if were the spark to retreat from the chair, from the table, from anything, it would just return to nothingness. It cannot exist without Hashem's creative force. That's the concept that he talks about in the second part of Tanya, from the Baal Shem Tov, that there's his havus tamidis, this continuous creation, right? That we learn that it's not true that Hashem. That Hashem created the world and then just left it to run. But no, Hashem has to recreate every moment the world from new, right? So this is what he's saying, that this tzimtzum, this great diminishing of the spark, comes into the thing, and that it is there. Hashem's spark is in the klippa just to keep it alive, so that it shouldn't return to nothingness. It should remain something which created something from nothing, so that it shouldn't continue to exist. Right? Lachen, and therefore he says... That's why Oilam Hazeh Umaloye, this world and everything that fills this world is referred to in Kabbalah as Oilam HaKlippas V'Sitra Achra. It's the world of Klippa and Sitra Achra. That's exactly what this world is. Right? On the surface, at least, anyways, right? Later we learn it's that, no, deep down there's potential in this world that we can reveal Hashem and so on. But on its face, it's a jungle. It's a place of it's a place of klippa and sitra achra. The lochein, and therefore, this is a tough world. Kol ma'is olam hazeh koshim v'roim. This is a world which is difficult and evil sometimes. V'roshoyim goyim bo, and it's a world where the evil people are allowed to triumph. They're allowed to, they're given room, and it sometimes seems like they're winning. K'moshe kosu v'etz chayim, like all this is explained in Etz Chayim, Sharm Mem Deis, at Sof Peregdal. Etz Chayim is the writings of Chaim Vital. On the Arizal, and he brings all those concepts over there in Kabbalistic ways. Right? Okay. So that's a description of Klippa. We're going to stop there, but what he's going to do next time is he's going to start explaining the two different types of Klippas. Right? Up to now, I just spoke about Klippa in general. We're going to talk about the two different types of Klippas. The Klippa that you can change a channel, and the Klippa you can't, and what happens to both of them.
So this world...
So that's a very, very good. It's a very, very good question. So, when the world was created before Adam and Chava, it was still a physical world. It was still a finite world. It was still a world of Klippa, but the godly consciousness was much stronger. In other words, it was obvious who created the world, right? Because evil wasn't mixed into everything. Adam and Chava took it to a world. When we say that this world is really a world of Klippa, and a world where to transform it, I mean, the Rebbe explains this in many other places, the world to transform it is real, we call a chidush, it's like taking something which is really not godly and turning it into something godly, which is amazing. That started from when, at least before the sin, it was much more potentially godly, at least. Now it seems like it's completely unholy, right? Now, we do say, and this is a very complicated and deep thing to understand, that although the first sin was a sin and they got punished for it, but there is a concept in Chassidus where very big sins, we find this by the Egel Hazor, by the Golden Calf, like classic sins, in other words, national sins, were kind of set up. It kind of had to happen because the real purpose of creation cannot really happen unless this world descends into the worst possible way. And then we can try, and then we're revealing Hashem in that world. Right, because dira b'tachtoinim, which is the buzzword of Chabad Chassidus particularly, which is making a dwelling place for Hashem in this world, the expression is dira b'tachtoinim, that Hashem wanted to dwell tachtoinim, in the lowest form of existence. Right, tachton means the bottom floor. Right, you don't want to live in top floor, you want to live in the bottom floor. So Chassidus says that means you have to have an existence she'ein tachton lemata himenu. You have to have such a bottom floor that there's nothing more bottom than that, nothing lower than that. And that really happened, not even by the creation, it happened after the sin. The world descended, and that's it. That was like rock bottom, where Hashem was just completely concealed. And that's where we... But that's the world. That is the purpose of creation. So it's, yes, on the surface, on the reality of the world is that's rock bottom, but it's actually the world that is connected with the essence of Hashem. That's for another time, but I'm saying that's the world Hashem wants. And He wants us to bring Him into it. Okay.